Glenn quit the drug habit, Ashland moved to California, and Glenn started selling houses left and right, thanks to his happy-go-lucky personality and his desire for self-improvement. Eddie sat down in Glenn's chair, and then, sotto voce, he explained. Design and build on Eagle Wing Lane, bit off more than he could chew, and did Glenn want to score an incredible deal and help Eddie out in the process by buying numbers 9 and 11. $1 million for both, a total steal. Glenn whistled.
$1 million?
He picked up a notepad and a pen.
How much did you pay for the land?
Eddie considered lying, but Glenn could easily go down to the registry of deeds and check his work.
$1.50 apiece, Eddie said.
So, 3, Glenn said. He wrote 300 on the notepad.
And how much did you dump into him?
Not 350 apiece, no way, they're barely framed, Ed. I've driven past.
About 2 apiece, Eddie said.
Glenn slammed his pen down.
Why come to me if you're just going to lie your ass off? I know Schuyler Pine designed all 3 for the price of 1 because you nominated him for Commodore of the Yacht Club.
Wait a minute, Eddie said.
How do you know that?
Glenn clammed up, fiddled with a notepad, tore the top sheet off, and crumpled it up.
He said, Don't include number 13 in your spiel to me, Eddie, if you're planning on keeping number 13 for yourself. Divide everything by thirds, not halves. 200 on the land. And maybe, $1.50 into each, but that's being generous. So that gives us 500. I don't see how you can come in here asking for $1 million.
Eddie remembered now why he hated Glenn Daly.
The guy was a douchebag. Obviously, Eddie came in asking for $1 million so he could have enough money to finish number 13 and sell it. Eddie said, When you're finished, you can sell them each for 1.2. Each, Glenn. So 2.4 on $1 million investment? Nearly $1.5 million profit?
I'll give you $500,000, Glenn said.
I'll call Ben Winford and I'll take them both off your hands today for $500,000.
Eddie stared at the numbers on Glenn's notepad. $500,000 was enough to make the mortgages go away and recoup about 1/4 of his initial investment. Then Eddie noticed the notepad itself. It was from the Four Seasons in Santa Barbara.
Hey, Eddie said. He was trying to form a thought, but it wouldn't quite crystallize.
When it did, Eddie swallowed.
No, he thought. No fucking way.
He pointed to the notepad. Have you ever stayed at the Four Seasons in Santa Barbara?
I hear it's really nice.
Glenn flipped the notepad over.
That's really none of your business, Eddie.
None of his business? P for personal? Barbie was sleeping with Glenn Daly.
Sleeping, quite literally, with the enemy.
She took trips with him to places like Santa Barbara. And she discussed business secrets like Eddie's deal with Schuyler Pine. Eddie's scalp prickled. Had Barbie told Glenn what they were doing on Low Beach Road?
She wouldn't.
Or would she? It might be good pillow talk. Hey, guess what? Eddie and I are running a whorehouse. Eddie tried to think like his sister. They had been so close their whole lives, and yet a part of Barbie, in adulthood anyway, had remained inscrutable. P for personal. There were things Barbie didn't want Eddie to know, like she was sleeping with big, fat, stupid, successful former druggie, Glenn Daly. Had she told him about the girls? No, Eddie didn't think so, because something in Glenn's expression shifted, and Eddie thought, he knows that I know.
900, Eddie said.
600, Glenn said.
700 and you've got a deal, Eddie said, though 700 wasn't quite enough to get him where he wanted to be.
But it was 700 more than he'd had 15 minutes earlier, so why not call it a victory? Eddie put on his Panama hat, the last one in his possession. He had wanted to replace the other 2, but he didn't have the money for such an extravagance. 700 grand, pay the mortgages on his commercial properties, pay the remaining bills on number 13, pay the mortgages on his house, also 1 or 2 months in arrears, pay Hester Fan's stupid fucking success bonus, pay for electricity and water and groceries and gas like the rest of America,
Maybe there would be enough to get the floors and countertops installed at number 13. Maybe talk to a drywall guy and painters so he would be that much closer to selling and be able to assure Madeline that her money would be coming along shortly.
I'll have Ben draw up the papers, Glenn said.
Lawyer's fees. 700 grand wasn't nearly enough. P for personal.
Thanks, bro,
Eddie said. Glenn Daly raised an eyebrow, and Eddie strolled out of the office.
Grace. The shift was minuscule, but Grace noticed it right away. Benton pulled away from their kiss a second sooner than he might have normally. He said he couldn't stay for lunch. On the night of the sunset soiree, he had professed his love in the middle of the street. He had made love to Grace in his own bed, a welcome change from the garden shed. But now he was acting strangely. Grace thought maybe he had been spooked on Friday morning when she met his truck in the driveway and told him that Eddie hadn't gone to work, that he was still upstairs asleep due to the fiasco with Allegra. Or maybe Benton was just doing that thing that men did when they got close to a woman and the feelings got scary. She wasn't sure, but Benton's timing couldn't have been worse. Grace needed him. She hadn't talked to Madeline in 3 days. Have you and Madeline had a falling out? It was almost like Blonde Sharon had predicted it. The only relationship Grace could count on had blown up. Madeline had been so angry. Grace hadn't even realized Madeline was capable of getting that angry. She was always so sunny and sweet, so California laid back. She took things in stride. She smiled. She listened. She excelled at understanding what she called the three sides to every story. Grace missed her so much. 50 or 60 times a day, something would happen and Grace would think, I have to tell Madeline. But then she would look at the phone and she would think of Madeline's words, Allegra is a cheater, and you, Grace, are a cheater. And Grace would shudder. Madeline didn't want to hear from her. Madeline thought she was a common harlot. It was awful heartache, fighting with her best friend. Madeline was probably hanging out at her apartment, breaking her writing discipline so she could meet Rachel McMahon for lunch. Eddie needed to pay Madeline back. Maybe if he did that, Madeline would be less angry and Grace could call. And now, on top of everything, Benton was acting funny. Grace said, Are you okay? You're acting funny.
No, I'm not acting funny, Benton said. I just can't stay for lunch today.
Nobody else is home if that's what you're worried about, Grace said. Eddie was back to work, Hope was at the rectory, and Allegra had gone into town to look for a volunteer job. She was to check in with either Eddie or Barbie in person at the office every hour. Neither Eddie nor Grace trusted that Allegra wouldn't simply slip off to the beach.
I'm not worried about that at all, Benton said.
He checked his phone. I have to go.
Go then, Grace said. You seem in a terrible hurry.
He sighed. Grace. We only have 2 weeks until they come, Grace said. She made a grand gesture with her hand. Does this yard look ready to you?
15 days, Benton said, and actually, yes, it does.
Grace couldn't figure out what was happening here. This was the same man who had spelled out his love for her, was it not? He had said he didn't care who heard him.
Then the worst came to mind.
Is McGovey coming today? Grace asked. Is she flying in from California?
No, Grace, Benton said. She is not flying in. I don't keep in touch with her. You know that.
Right, Grace said. I'm sorry. It's just that you seem distant, like you're pulling away.
Benton slid his phone into his pocket and faced Grace.
You should probably give your girls some attention.
I'm sorry, Grace said. Are you telling me how to parent?
I had a conversation with Hope, Benton said. It was no big deal, but even she told me Allegra was heading for trouble. I feel like I'm taking you away from your number one responsibility.
No, you're not, Grace said. The girls are, well, they're 16. If I paid more attention to them, they would call me annoying and tell me to go away.
Benton sighed. You're right. I have no business telling you how to parent.
Is something else bothering you? Grace asked. Something you're afraid to tell me?
Benton nodded slowly. I think people are talking about us.
Do you?
There's a woman named Donna who works for Mrs. Alamand, and she heard Madeline King was writing some sexy novel about a woman and her contractor. I guess people are saying it's based on you and me.
Madeline?
Grace said. Madeline? Was writing a new novel, but Grace didn't know the subject.
You haven't told Madeline about us, have you?
Benton asked.
No, Grace said. She feared the tops of her ears would burst into flames, giving her away.
I know she's your best friend, Benton said.
Was my best friend, Grace said. She isn't speaking to me right now because of this thing with Allegra.
She's not writing this as some kind of revenge, then, is she? Benton asked.
No, Grace said. But her mind was racing to the night when Grace invited Madeline up to her study and then all those phone calls. Madeline knew every detail. If she were writing a book. But no, Madeline wouldn't do that. Not even as a revenge tactic.
Two of the women at this table will betray the person on their left.
Grace shook her head to clear it.
Who's Donna? She said.
And where did she hear this rumor?
I guess she's friends with a girl named Greta, who's the nanny for that blonde woman, Sharon, that we saw at the party.
Oh, God, Grace said. Sharon is awful. Sharon makes stuff up all the time and tries to pass it off as the truth.
Well, all I'm saying is what I heard.
I thought you didn't care. Who knew? Grace said. That's what you said the other night.
I had been drinking.
So you do care?
Well, I don't love being the subject of gossip. I have a business to run. I hate to generalize like this, but it's the women who hire me. However, it's the men who pay the bills.
But this all reflects much more poorly on you, Grace.
I don't want anyone thinking badly of you.
Grace took a deep breath. I'm ready to leave Eddie.
Benton raised his eyebrows in an expression of boyish hope.
Really?
Really, she said. Then she thought about the twins. Allegra was already such a mess, and Hope was fragile.
Benton read the doubt off her face, maybe, because he said, Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Let's just work on the yard for the shoot for now.
Grace nodded.
Okay,
he said. I'll stay for lunch tomorrow, Grace, I promise. He bent down and kissed her in a way that turned her inside out.
I love you.
And I love you, Grace said.
Benton strode away, and a few seconds later, Grace heard the engine of his truck. She ran upstairs to her study and called Madeline. 3 rings. 4 rings. Voicemail.
Grace said, There's a rumor going around that you're writing your new novel about a woman having an affair with her contractor, and apparently some people think it's about me and Benton?
This had better not be true, Madeline.
Grace swallowed.
This had better not be true.
Madeline. She hadn't held up much hope that Brick would want to ease his heartache by spending time with his mother, but Madeline offered and Brick accepted. In the week following Allegra's deception, they hung out together. The first day, they grabbed sandwiches from Something Natural and drove out to Sesachacha Pond, where Madeline sat at the water's edge and Brick listened to music on his headphones. The second day, it rained, so they went to the movies at the Dreamland Theater, each with their own tub of popcorn and a box of milk duds. The third day, they rode their bikes to Mattaquette and napped on the beach until the sun set in orange and pink streaks. Then Trevor met them at Millie's for fish tacos. The fourth day, Brick wanted to stay home and chill, whatever that meant, so Madeline wrote in her apartment all day. The fifth day, Brick asked Madeline if she wanted to join him and Parker Mars at Cisco Beach.
Sure, Madeline said.
Parker was smaller in stature than Brick's other friends, but he was smart and funny and related well to adults, and Madeline enjoyed his company. When she pulled into the parking lot at Cisco, she said, Are you sure you want me tagging along? I can just drop you guys and come back and pick you up later.
You should definitely join us, Mrs. Llewellyn, Parker said. Our social cred will skyrocket in the presence of a beautiful woman.
Dude, chill,
Brick said. He smiled for the first time in who knew how long. It's my mom.
Should I just drop you? Madeline asked Brick.
No, Mom, come with us. It's cool, Brick said. Madeline followed the boys down to the beach and set up three chairs. Cisco was home to the Nantucket surf scene. Young guys in wetsuits standing possessively next to their boards, and the gorgeous, underfed girls who loved them. Madeline also recognized the elder statesmen of surf, men like Sultan Nash, the house painter, and Thornton Bale, paving king, who had ditched work for waves. Then there was a slew of aspirants, from kids Brick's age all the way down to fourth and fifth graders. Brick charged into the water to body surf, while Parker plopped into the chair next to Madeline.
I think he's doing a little better each day, Parker said.
Madeline nearly laughed. Do you?
He's my bro, Parker said, and he got done wrong by that...
Well, excuse my French, Mrs. Llewellyn, but by that bitch, Panchik. That's the risk you take when you date a beautiful girl. Allegra is the most popular girl in school. Well, her and Hollis. I mean, I have no prayer of scoring even one date with someone of their caliber. But the good thing...
Parker held an arm out to indicate Brick, floating alone over the swells, is that I do not own a timeshare in Heartbreak City.
You guys are all really young, Madeline said. I think maybe Brick and Allegra were too immature for an exclusive relationship.
It sounds like you're letting Allegra off the hook, Mrs. Llewellyn, Parker said, and I hate to see you being a softie. Allegra had been cheating on him for a while. I saw her at the Cape Cod Mall with Ian back in April. They were at the Chanel counter. I mean, come on. Is it not totally obvious what game Allegra was playing? She picked an older guy with money. Brick never stood a chance.
Parker let out a weary sigh. I just hope our boy bounces back.
Madeline reached over and squeezed Parker's arm. He's lucky he has a good friend like you.
I love that kid, Parker said. He's my bro.
Madeline smiled, and then she brought her legal pad out of her book bag.
Is that your new novel? Parker asked. My mom tells me it's a real doozy.
Madeline had received Grace's voicemail.
This had better not be true, Madeline.
This had better not be true. But it hadn't stopped Madeline's progress on the novel, or even slowed her down. Madeline was going to write B/G until Eddie paid her back her money. As soon as Madeline got home from the beach, her phone started to buzz. Rachel McMahon. Madeline was tempted to let it go to voicemail, but to be honest, she was starved for female interaction. She ached for Grace every second of every day.
You're not going to believe this, Rachel said.
Madeline sniffed. She already didn't like the way this conversation was going.
What? She said. I heard, Rachel said, that Grace Panchik,
oh God, Madeline said,
took Benton Coe, her gardener, as her date to the sunset soiree, and now Jean Burton thinks she's pregnant.
Pregnant? Madeline said.
Grace?
This pierced her. She had tried and tried and tried to have another baby. If Grace had gotten accidentally pregnant by Benton Coe,
but no, uh-oh, no way, not possible. This was gossip at its most insidious.
Rachel, Madeline said, there is nothing going on between Grace and Benton Coe. Grace is happily married to Eddie, so please, Rachel.
Yes,
Rachel said,
mind your own business. Madeline said.
Eddie. He walked into the office with one thing on his mind. He had tried calling Barbie at home and he'd left two messages on her cell. No response. Eloise was in but on the phone. Eddie collapsed into Barbie's chair. She was wearing a red Diane von Furstenberg wrap dress and 4-inch Manolos and the whopper pearl at her throat. Eddie wondered if Glenn Daly had ever held that pearl between his teeth. He said,
I'm selling numbers 9 and 11 Eagle Wing Lane to Glenn Daly.
Yes, she said,
I know. You know, Eddie said, Someone in his office sent over the paperwork, Barbie said. On her desk were two large coffees from the Handlebar Cafe, Barbie's new favorite place. She handed one to Eddie that was loaded with milk. Thank you, Eddie said. Barbie never brought him coffee. So this was a peace offering, or a please don't hate me for sleeping with Glenn Daly offering. Eddie was dying to address the issue, but he feared that to do so would be to embarrass them both. But he wanted her to know that he knew. He knew, for sure. From now on, he said, I'm going to schedule the girls. Barbie shot a glance across the room at Eloise. She nodded. She was so damn insouciant that Eddie wanted to pick up her stapler and throw it across the office just to get a response. Okay, he said. Okay, she said. The next group in was Night Bill, a little more than 2 weeks hence. It was some kind of accounting or payroll firm from Kansas City. The contact person was a man named Bugsy Greer. Bugsy, Eddie thought. He had checked the guy's photo out online. Quite frankly, he looked like someone from a horror show. He was completely bald, and there was something wrong with his teeth. Eddie had wondered which of the girls would have to have sex with Bugsy Greer, but then he shuddered and tried to think of something pleasant. Hot air balloons, Christmas trees. He was very nervous as he prepared to make the phone call. He left the office with his cell phone and loitered at the edge of the Nantucket Yacht Club parking lot. It was now summer, which meant that Eddie had to be more careful, or the attendant stationed at the guardhouse would tell Eddie to scram, or one of the old ladies carrying a Nantucket lightship basket would scold him. He lingered on the far side of a brand new Range Rover. He wished he'd listened more carefully to Barbie when she was propositioning these groups. Bugsy answered, Hello? Eddie spoke so quickly he tripped over his words. Hey there, Bugsy. This is Eddie Panchik, your real estate agent on Nantucket. Excited about coming to the island? Need any dinner reservations? Pearl? Crew? Ventuno? And then Eddie said, Listen, here's something for on the down low. We have a cleaning crew of 5 Russian girls who do more than just clean. Really? Bugsy said, his voice perking up. Really? Eddie said. They can come back at night if you'd like. We would like, Bugsy said. Would you? Eddie said. He took some steady breaths. You understand me, then? I think so, yes, Bugsy said. How much? $12,000 a night, Eddie said. He felt both bad and good about raising the price. He was going to keep the extra $2,000 for himself. Sleeping with Glenn Daly. That's fine, Bugsy said. Will you pay night by night or all at once? Eddie asked. Which do you prefer? All at once, Eddie said. If you can make that happen, Bugsy. I can make that happen, Bugsy said. Bugsy was obviously some kind of nickname, and Eddie felt ridiculous using it. I can make anything happen. I like the confidence of that statement, Eddie said. A few days later, when Eddie checked his voicemail, there was a message from Madeline. He thought maybe she was calling to express her dismay or anger over Allegra's behavior, and Eddie was ready to list all the ways he'd punished his daughter. He'd taken away her phone, and she was grounded until further notice. No beach with friends, no parties, and she was never to see the Coburn kid again. But it turned out that Madeline wasn't calling about Allegra. The message said, I've called Leighton Gray, Eddie. Leighton Gray was the Llewellyn's attorney, the very same attorney Eddie himself had recommended back when they needed someone to do their real estate closing. He's going to take action against you unless you pay us back by the end of next week. I'm being nice here, Eddie. You've got 10 days. Then she hung up. What? Eddie said. No goodbyes? He was selling numbers 9 and 11 to Glenn Daly, and he would use some of the cash to pay Madeline and Trevor back. He would get out from under his debt, and he would live his life on the straight and narrow as soon as he could. He called home to check in with Grace and the girls. How long had it been since he'd called just because? He would do it more often, he decided. He would do it every day. Grace said, Hi there. She sounded perplexed. Everything okay?
Just checking in, Eddie said. How's everything there? Are the girls home?
Yes, Grace said. They're both here. Neither of them is working today, so the 3 of us are going to the galley for lunch.
Eddie wondered if grounding Allegra could reasonably mean taking her to the galley for lunch, but he knew how much Grace wanted special together times with the twins, and that would never happen unless Allegra were grounded. Sad fact. Eddie himself loved the galley for lunch, or sunset cocktails, although he hadn't gone yet this summer. It was pricey. He wished Grace were tougher and had suggested Allegra take over mowing the lawn.
"Allegra seems different," Grace said.
"In a good way or a bad way?" Eddie asked.
"Good way?" Grace said. "Like she might actually be contrite?"
"Yeah, well, she'd better be," Eddie said.
He needed to hang up before his good mood evaporated completely.
"Glad to hear things are headed in that direction. Have fun at lunch."
"We will," Grace said.
Hope. In a mere 4 days, Allegra's world had imploded like a dying star. On the morning after, Hope had relented and allowed Allegra to use her phone to text Brick and Hollis and her other friends. But the results weren't pretty. Brick told her to never contact him again. He said she had made a joke of him. He had loved her as well as he knew how, but clearly it wasn't enough love or the right kind of love, which was fine. But he wasn't going to waste another second on her. "Goodbye and good luck," he said. The calm, firm words freaked Allegra out. Hope had never seen her sister lose her composure in this way. Allegra was screaming. Her hair was wild, and she tore around Hope's bedroom as though looking for a way off the Titanic. She stared at Hope's phone, saying, "What do I tell him? How do I get him to forgive me?" Hope sighed. She wished that she, like Cyrano de Bergerac, had magic words to offer her sister. But even with as little experience as Hope had with relationships, she knew that Brick was beyond Allegra's reach at this point. He might forgive her in 10 years, or more likely 20 or 30, when he was 46 and possibly had a tempestuous 16-year-old daughter of his own.
"I don't know," she said.
Allegra handed Hope the phone and said, "Here, you text him. He's always liked you. He respects you. Tell him I'm not doing well. Tell him to at least take my phone call."
"Okay," Hope said. She sent Brick a text that said, "Hot glass looks like cool glass." She waited. Surely he would respond to their secret code.
Nothing. She texted, "My sister isn't doing well. She's probably too selfish to actually kill herself, but high anxiety and depression are likely. Can you please just talk to her? Thanks. Your friend, Hope." Brick responded, "Please, never contact me again." Hope texted, "It's me, Hope, really. Hot glass looks like cool glass." Brick texted, "Yes, I know, Hope. Please never contact me again." Hope felt stung. This was not how it was supposed to go. Hope and Brick were supposed to forge a secret connection, a deep, simpatico understanding that would lead to Brick falling in love with her. Brick was supposed to realize that Hope was everything Allegra was, only she was also good, nice, kind, and honest. Hope threw the phone down on the bed. "He hates me too, apparently." Allegra started to wail. She picked the phone up to call him again. And that was when the screen started blowing up with texts from Hollis, Hannah, Kenzie, and Bluto. And none of them were very nice. Hope read the texts over Allegra's shoulder and cringed at the names her friends were calling her. Boozehound, pothead, anorexic slut.
"Do I look anorexic?"
Allegra asked, showing Hope the photo.
"Well, you don't look fat,"
Hope said, in a voice meant to point out a silver lining. In fact, despite the gruesome circumstances, the photo of Allegra was gorgeous in a way, minus the booze and dope. Allegra and Ian might have been doing a shoot for fragrance.
"Maybe the photo will go viral, and someone at a modeling agency will see it?"
Allegra gave her sister a hopeful, watery gaze.
"You think? Maybe?"
A text came in from Bluto. "Lying, cheating, slut."
"Maybe,"
Hope said.
Allegra put up a good fight. She had some choice words for Hollis and Kenzie, and she unleashed a mighty wrath on Bluto, calling him a lard-ass succubus. When she ran out of oomph, she fell back on the bed next to Hope. She said,
"I don't know what to do."
Hope said, "They'll come round. It doesn't matter." The toothpaste is out of the tube. You can't call someone a lying, cheating slut and then take it back. These are relationship destroyers. It's all Hollis's fault. She's been waiting for years to knock me down. Hope had to concede that this might be true. Hollis and Allegra were pretty well matched, but Allegra had always been just a little bit luckier. Now that she had proved herself fallible, Hollis would surely retain the title of Queen Bee. "This too shall pass away," Hope said. "So what do I do until then?" Hope didn't understand the question and said so. "What do I do until it passes away?" Allegra said. "I don't have a job like you. Now I can't go to the beach. I'm forbidden from leaving the house, for starters, but even if I weren't grounded, I couldn't go to the beach alone." "Well," Hope said, "you could always read." "Read?" Allegra said. Her tone of voice contained actual wonder, as if to say, "What?" As if to say, "Why would I do that?" Hope tossed her sister the copy of Lolita. Hope had recently finished it and was thus able to claim personhood. The book had been excellent, thought-provoking, original, and weird. "Read this," Hope said. "There are some big words in it. It'll help you with your critical reading score." Allegra studied the cover of the book skeptically. "Lolita? Vladimir Nabokov. Is it even in English?" "Yes," Hope said. "It's about a grown man named Humbert Humbert who abducts a 13-year-old girl and drives with her across America." "Sick," Allegra said, but Hope could tell her interest was piqued. Allegra had stayed in Hope's bedroom all of that first bad day, reading and napping, and Hope stayed in the room as well. She plowed through most of House of Mirth, and then she practiced her flute. She told herself she was staying in her room to watch over her sister so that she didn't do anything stupid. But really, Hope was just enjoying their quiet camaraderie. When Hope finished playing a selection from Mozart's Flute Concerto in G, Allegra, who was lying on her back staring at the ceiling, with Lolita splayed open on her chest, said, "You're really good." "I wish I were good at something." Hope said, "You're good at things." "Like what?" Hope took her flute apart and pulled felt through the mouthpiece. The things that Allegra was good at, being pretty, being popular, were pretty compromised at that moment. "Like what, Hope?" "Like lots of things," Hope said. "I'm not going to sit here and enumerate your many talents." "Because you can't," Allegra said. "Because I don't have any talents, because I'm a mean-hearted, cheating, lying tramp." "Oh, stop it," Hope said. "You made a mistake is all. We're young. We're supposed to make mistakes, learn from them, and move on." "Tell me one good thing about myself," Allegra said. "Please, one thing." "You have a great sense of style," Hope said. Allegra was quiet. Her eyes closed. "You're right," she said. "I do." Hope would have guessed that Allegra's newfound humility would be short-lived, and that by the end of the first day of shame, she would have tired of Hope's company. But on the second week, Allegra had managed to score a volunteer job at the Wheezy Library for Children, shelving books part-time. Their mother was so pleased that she suggested lunch at the galley, just the three of them. Allegra not only agreed, but actually seemed excited. Excited to be seen in public, with Grace and Hope? Well, it would get her out of the house. She would be relieved about that, maybe. And the galley was fancy, so she would have a chance to dress up. Hope wore her strapless Lily Pulitzer dress, with the turquoise and white butterfly print. Allegra wore a jade green patio dress from Teabags, Los Angeles, and a pair of Dolce Vita gladiator sandals. Hope had French braided her hair, but Allegra did some messy half-up, half-down style right out of Vogue. "It's really not fair how beautiful you are," Hope said. Allegra actually seemed embarrassed. "You look just like me," she said. "We're identical twins." "Except you're Alice," Hope said, "and I'm the Dormouse." "Stop," Allegra said. She lifted the end of Hope's braid and tickled Hope's nose with it. We can both be Alice. Lunch at the galley was fun and special, despite Grace announcing every 5 minutes how fun and special it was. Grace took their picture at the entrance to the beautiful beachfront restaurant, and then, once they were all seated, she had their waiter take a photo of the three of them. "These are my twin girls," Grace announced, loudly enough for half the restaurant to hear. "I can't believe how lucky I am today. This is so special." Hope turned to Allegra to shoot an eye roll, but Allegra was smiling at their mother in earnest. Question mark? Hope thought. Allegra seemed totally into the mother-daughter-daughter luncheon. It was weird. A month ago, if Grace had suggested this outing, Allegra would have flat-out refused. Or if Grace had guilted or threatened her enough, she would have sat sullenly at the table and texted the entire time. Of course, now there was no phone and no one to text. Grace ordered a glass of white wine, Allegra a Diet Coke, Hope an iced tea. They did a cheers. Grace said, "This is so fun. This is so, so special. Thank you for joining me." "You don't have to thank us for coming to lunch with you," Allegra said. "You're our mother." Maybe Allegra is being nice in an attempt to become ungrounded, Hope thought. She was doing such a good job, it might actually work. Grace ordered the gazpacho and the Gruyere and spring onion omelet. Allegra ordered the lobster salad. Hope ordered the mixed greens with blueberries and goat cheese and a side of fries. They were seated with a view overlooking the white beach, the lifeguard stand, the blue, green, and yellow umbrellas of Cliffside, and the placid blue water of Nantucket Sound. Sailboats dotted the horizon, and the steamship cut its way over to Hyannis. A breeze lifted the lip of the awning. "As I'm sure you probably know," Grace said, "the Boston Globe is coming to do a photo shoot and feature article on our garden next week, so Benton will be around a lot to help me get the garden ready." Allegra said, "Benton who?" "Mom's gardener," Hope said. "He's the one who gave me Lolita." "I really like that book," Allegra said. "I mean, it's disturbing, but it's holding my interest. What are you reading, Hope?" Hope said, "House of Mirth, Edith Wharton." Grace said, "I read that a million years ago during my freshman year at Holyoke." "Maybe I'll read that next," Allegra said. Hope thought, "Where's my sister?" They ordered a brownie sundae with three spoons, and Grace got a cappuccino and the check. As Grace paid the bill, Allegra nudged Hope under the table. Mrs. Kraft, their English teacher, was headed straight for them. "Look at the lovely Panchik ladies lunching," Mrs. Kraft said. She beamed at the table. Grace stood up and gave Mrs. Kraft an air kiss. "Hello, Ruth." Hope wondered if she and Allegra would be expected to greet Mrs. Kraft in such a manner. Air kiss her English teacher? She couldn't bring herself to do anything but wave. Ruth Kraft, all the kids called her Ruthie behind her back, had a cumulus cloud of frizzy brown hair. She had been trained as an opera singer, and her classroom trademark was to belt out those phrases to which she wanted to give emphasis. Allegra especially liked to imitate her. "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" Mrs. Kraft had given Allegra a D. But there was Allegra, beaming an angelic smile anyway, saying, "I am Mrs. Kraft." Mrs. Kraft said, "And how's our summer going?" Something about the way she sang it out made it sound like she was fishing for information. Was it possible that Mrs. Kraft had heard about Allegra getting caught drinking and smoking pot while modeling her underwear for Ian Coburn? If Mrs. Kraft knew, then it was official. Everyone knew. Had Mrs. Kraft seen the photo? Hope felt seriously bad for her sister. News like that would quickly make its way around the faculty room in the fall, and Allegra would have no one to ask for letters of recommendation. Last week, Hope would have found this gratifying. But now, she and Allegra were like the Corsican brothers. Someone kicked Allegra in the shin, and Hope felt the pain. "The girls were just talking about all the books they've been reading," Grace said. "Speaking of reading," Mrs. Kraft said. She turned her attention now to Grace. "Have you heard about the new Madeline King novel? It's supposed to be quite scandalous." "I haven't heard a thing," Grace said. and with a hand motion like the one Father Declan used at Mass, she indicated that the girls should both stand up. "I've been busy with the garden and the hens."
"I just figured you would know about it," Mrs. Kraft said, "since you and Madeline are such close friends."
"Actually," Grace said, "Madeline and I aren't speaking at the moment." This seemed to throw Mrs. Kraft for a loop-de-loop. She answered in a normal speaking voice. "Oh, I'm so sorry. Open mouth. Insert espadrille. I should never have brought it up." Grace smiled ruefully and fiddled with the clasp of her purse. "Probably not." Hope studied her mother. She wasn't speaking to Madeline. This was outrageous news. So outrageous that Hope thought her mother was lying. But then she realized that there had been an absence the past week or so. Her mother hadn't been locked in her study on the phone with Madeline, like she usually was. Was it because of what had happened between Allegra and Brick? Or was it because Grace was so engrossed by Benton in the garden? Every once in a while, it occurred to Hope that her mother was a human being with her own complicated set of emotions. She wondered if Grace and Madeline had had a fight, like Allegra and Hollis. But weren't Grace and Madeline too old for that kind of behavior? Hope shifted her weight. She wanted to tell Mrs. Kraft to buzz off, go sing her arias or recite her sonnets, leave their mother alone. As if sharing this very same thought, Allegra spoke up. "It was nice to see you, Mrs. Kraft. Enjoy your lunch." "Oh," Mrs. Kraft said. She seemed so taken aback by this polite rebuff from her worst student that she wobbled on the wedge heels of her espadrilles. "Yes, thank you. I will." Hope gave Mrs. Kraft a second little wave, this one of farewell, and followed her mother and sister out of the restaurant. Grace. Nantucket had a week of heat, and when Grace said heat, she meant temperatures in the high 80s and low 90s. It was hot enough that the girls would come home from their volunteer jobs and jump right into the pool, and Grace would stay inside with the central air conditioning cranked, unless she was tending the chickens or Benton was around. Benton came only for a perfunctory hour, and he was all business. He couldn't stay for lunch or for any other reason. His other gardens were in crisis, he said, because of the heat. Then the heat broke, and they got 2.5 days of relentless, pounding rain. On the first rainy day, Benton texted, "Not coming today. Staying home to catch up on paperwork." Grace curled up in bed and fought off a migraine. Was she really going to consider leaving Eddie for this man? The second day, he texted, "Not coming today. Doing bills. BTW, I have a substantial one for Eddie. You might want to warn him." Migraine, Grace thought. Not coming today to see the woman you love, or your pet project sending Eddie a substantial bill. Which would send Eddie through the roof. He was still complaining about Hester Fan's fee, and when Grace had broached the matter of Madeline and Trevor's $50,000, Eddie had glared at Grace and said, "Honestly, Grace, what do you think I do all day?" Madeline hadn't responded to Grace's voicemail, and Grace began to worry that she'd done further damage to the relationship. She went back and forth between believing that Madeline was writing a novel about her and Benton, two of the women at this table will betray the person on their left, and thinking that it was just a bad rumor cooked up by blonde Sharon. But then Ruth Kraft mentioned Madeline's book, and Grace wondered how ditzy Ruth Kraft would have found out about it. It must be true. It couldn't be true. Madeline would never, ever do that, no matter how angry she was. Would she? If it were true, Grace would, she would be so mad that she couldn't fathom what she would do. She had shared everything with Madeline in confidence. They had been friends for nearly 20 years. Madeline would never, Grace decided. It was just a rumor. Unless Madeline was exacting some kind of revenge. Allegra is a cheater, and you, Grace, are a cheater. What Madeline clearly didn't understand was that Grace was in love. There was nothing she could do about it. The pain in her head descended, pressure like a lead helmet, squeezing, squeezing, crushing her skull. She was in love. She was dying to talk to Madeline and get the mess sorted out, But really, Grace wanted only Benton. On a trip to the bathroom, the only reason she rose from bed, she stared out the window at her soggy backyard. A garden was no good in the rain. Happiness restored. The sun came out. Benton returned with a big smile and a ferocious appetite for Grace. He loved her again. The big day was nearly upon them. Lawn mowed and trimmed, beds weeded, roses blooming, perennial bed freshly mulched, daylilies deheaded, pool skimmed, chaise arranged with pillows plumped, grill scrubbed, deck swept, canvas umbrella cleaned, Adirondack chairs wiped down, hammock tightened. Together, Benton and Grace walked every inch of the property, clipping blossoms for an arrangement, smoothing imperfections in the white shell driveway, filling the bird feeders. "It's ready," Benton said. He kissed Grace deeply up against the side of his truck. "I'll see you tomorrow." Clara Teasdale, the Boston Globe's home and garden editor, and Big George, a Globe staff photographer, arrived in a car driven by Bernie Wu. Bernie and Grace were friendly because Bernie Wu's daughter, Chloe, played the flute in the student orchestra with Hope. Apparently, Bernie felt comfortable enough in his friendship with Grace that he showed up 45 minutes early and bypassed the front door. He walked Clara and Big George around the side of the house to the backyard. He had stopped at the hen house and pointed at each chicken, indiscriminately naming them. Martha, Dolly, Eleanor, Ladybird, Hillary. Bernie Wu's wife was a big fan of Grace's eggs and was good for 5 dozen a month. Clara laughed at the names. "First ladies," she said. Grace and Benton were making fast, furious love in the garden shed. Grace clinging to Benton, wanting him farther and farther inside of her, wanting to become him. He thrilled her. He challenged her. He was her great, big, shining sun. Grace heard what she thought were voices. Then she clearly heard a female voice say, "First ladies!" She pulled away from Benton. "They're here." "Already?" Benton said. He checked his watch. 45 minutes early?" Silently, they adjusted their clothes. Grace tried to smooth the wrinkles out of her pale pink linen shift. "You ready?" she asked. Benton nodded, and Grace swung open the door to the shed and stepped out to greet their visitors. Grace noted the confused expression on Bernie's face when Benton followed her out. He was at least holding a rake and a clipboard. Bernie then started speaking very quickly. Grace could tell he was nervous, but whether that was because he had overstepped his bounds by barging into the backyard, or because he realized he had interrupted something, she wasn't sure. Maybe he was just impressed by Clara and Big George, and by the idea of Grace and Eddie's yard being featured in the Boston Globe. Grace hoped that was it, and she endeavored to set everything back to normal while continuously smoothing the front of her dress. She tried not to think of Benton's hands lifting it. "Well, I'm off," Bernie said. "I'll be back here to pick you up at 12:30. He gave Grace a smile of what seemed like genuine good luck, and she waved. Big George was already at the far edge of the property, shooting a stream of photos of the Adirondack chairs and the placid blue surface of Pulpus Harbor beyond, framed by Grace's blue lace hydrangeas. Clara Teasdale was smitten with the yard, and probably also with Benton, who was taking enormous pride in showing off his favorite features. The rocks of the stream bed, the perennials, the roses which were luscious enough to eat. The entire property was showing off. Benton lingered by the bench that held the potted ferns, and he described how he'd found the only Parisian antiques dealer wise enough to salvage the old benches from the Jardin des Tuileries. Grace took over with Clara when it was time to talk about the hens. She even let Clara harvest half a dozen pale blue eggs from the nesting boxes, despite the lady's clucking disapproval at a stranger performing this task. Grace then threw open the door to the garden shed and listened to Clara ooh and ah over Grace's collection of watering cans and the high polish of the copper sink and the practicality yet allure of the soapstone countertop. Big George snapped photos in a constant clicking stream. Grace showed off the riding mower in its alcove. Then Big George asked Grace if she wouldn't mind bringing it out to the middle of the emerald green grass and perching upon it in her pink linen sheath. Click, click, click. As the hour wore on, there were suggestions of other fanciful photos. One of Benton amid the roses, brandishing the largest set of clippers. One of Grace standing ankle-deep in the shallow end of her pool. and one of both Benton and Grace hanging from their arms from the branch of the big elm. Then it was time for lunch. They hadn't discussed lunch as part of the shoot, but nevertheless, Grace had gone all out. She'd made 6 kinds of tea sandwich, egg salad, naturally, cucumber and herbed cream cheese, radish and sweet butter, curried chicken salad, roast beef with horseradish mayo, and ham and baby Swiss. She had also bought 3 cartons of big, fat strawberries, and she'd made meringues and fresh lime curd. Big George snapped photos of the food, and Grace was tickled. She pulled a bottle of Schramsberg Rosé sparkling wine from Eddie's wine cellar, and using Grace's 10-inch chef's knife, Benton sabered off the top. The cork landed in the daylily bed, and everyone cheered. Grace, Benton, and Clara sat for the lunch, and they posed for Big George. Grace fed Benton a strawberry. Clara overfilled her champagne flute and drowned her ham and Swiss. Grace made Big George a plate piled high with sandwiches, and when he stopped to eat, Grace stole his camera and took pictures of him stuffing his face. Benton said to George, "Are you a Stones fan, man?" George said, "Isn't everybody?" Benton plugged his phone into the outdoor speaker and played Loving Cup. He poured the last of the sparkling wine between Grace's and Clara's glasses. Benton said, "This has sort of been the theme song for our summer." Clara said, "I can honestly say I've never had this much fun at a shoot before." Grace agreed. It was fun. She envisioned life with Benton being this playful, this sensuous and carefree every single day. As Clara finished her wine, she ran through the notes she'd taken aloud. Benton, Ohio State grounds crew work, study job, Surrey, England, passion for roses, Savannah, Oxford, the Nantucket Historical Association. Clara looked up and narrowed her eyes. "How did you find Grace?" Benton gave Grace a look that could only be described as filled with love. "She found me," he said. Click, click. Nantucket. Many of us knew the Panchik property would be featured in Sunday's Boston Globe, but others were taken by surprise as we stirred cream and sugar into our freshly brewed coffee and opened our newspapers. However, even those of us who knew to expect the article were astonished by what we saw. For starters, the article was entitled Nantucket's Private Eden. And the first photo? Bam! Larger than life and in full color was of Grace Panchik feeding Benton Co. a fat, delectable strawberry. Whoa! The caption read, "Homeowner Grace Panchik enjoys an alfresco luncheon with landscape architect Benton Co., owner of Co. Designs." The article read, "Some matches are made in heaven, such as the one between Nantucket resident Grace Panchik and Benton Co., the man she hired to design and execute the landscaping of her 3-acre property in Wawanet." Whoa. Followed by a few paragraphs of background on Benton. Impressive, but nothing we didn't already know. Followed by a few paragraphs of background on Grace. Mrs. Panchik was a French literature major at Mount Holyoke College, which explains her fondness for the garden bench, salvaged from the Jardin des Tuileries, that is said to date back to the age of Louis XIV. Colbert, and the renowned Parisian landscape architect André Le Nôtre. This exact bench used to grace a long terrace overlooking the Seine, called the Terrasse du Bord de l'Eau, and most likely provided respite for the likes of Auguste Renoir and Claude Monet after a tiring visit to the nearby Louvre. Such vivid historical details thrill Mrs. Panchik and fuel her romantic imagination. Mrs. Panchik is also passionate about her daylily bed, which she planted as a tribute to her beloved, now-deceased grandmother, Sabine Rodin-Bast, who kept an estate in Wayland with an apple orchard and a croquet lawn. "My grandmother Sabine adored daylilies," Mrs. Panchik said. "She was the one who fostered my deep appreciation for green spaces." Followed by a photo collage, Grace aboard a riding mower, looking not unlike a queen upon a throne, Grace and Benton hanging side by side from a branch like children on a playground. Grace drinking from a flute of champagne as Benton gazed upon her. Grace wading in the shallow end of her pool. Benton standing in the rose bed with a gargantuan pair of clippers. one of the hens, Martha or Dolly, strutting in the yard, and the inside of the garden shed, copper farmer's sink, gleaming like a new penny. The sign above the sink read, "A garden is not a matter of life or death. It is far more important than that." Followed by paragraphs about how Grace and Benton collaborated on every aspect of the yard in their attempt to create different moments. The pool and hot tub, tiled in bottle green and surrounded by antique pavers and real Nantucket cobblestones, made one feel that one had happened across a swimming hole in the woods. The rolling green lawn encouraged a stroll toward the Adirondack chairs, set where one could simultaneously hear the stream that ran along the back of the Panchik property and see the sailboats on Pulpis Harbor. Suspended between 200-year-old elms was a hammock where Mrs. Panchik often relaxed as she read Victor Hugo and Alexandre Dumas within full view of the glorious rose bed featuring 22 varieties of rose. "But the essence of what we were trying to accomplish," Coe says, "is embodied in the garden shed." Mrs. Panchik agrees. "That's really our baby," she says. Jody Ruys called Susan Prendergast. "I, for one, think it's disgusting," she said. "I mean, is it not obvious to everyone on Earth that those two are lovers? She was feeding him."
"Like Adam and Eve in the garden," Susan said. "Do you think the writer had inside information?"
"There was no mention of Eddie," Jody said. "I mean, they referred to her as Mrs. Panchik, but it was like Eddie and the twins didn't exist."
"I have to say, the way Benton is looking at her in that one photo is pretty hot," Susan said. "I wish someone would look at me like that."
"I thought the mention of the bench from the Tuileries was pretentious."
"And Grace reads Victor Hugo in the hammock," Jody said. "It's probably more like Cosmo."
"She was a French literature major," Susan said. "I hear her library is stacked with first editions."
"Well, what about Grace calling the garden shed their baby?" Jody said.
"You know, Jean Burton thought she looked pregnant. I think there's a good chance that shed isn't the only baby."
"Her roses are absolutely incredible," Susan said. "You have to give her that."
"Fine," Jody said. "I'll give her that."
Dr. Andy McMahon saw the paper first. Normally, he savored the solitude of his Sunday mornings. Calgary slept late, and Rachel slept even later. This allowed Dr. Andy to sit out on his deck, enjoy the sunshine and the breeze, drink his coffee, eat his lightly buttered rye toast and half a ripe avocado, listen to Schubert, and read the Globe. He usually skipped the home and garden section, but his eye happened to catch a glimpse of the word Nantucket, and he checked to see what it was all about. Grace Panchik's yard. Some hotshot landscaper. Dr. Andy read the article and studied the pictures, and a feeling of distinct discomfort started at the base of his spine and traveled up to his neck. His landlord, Eddie Panchik, was being cuckolded by this co-fellow. That much was obvious. Dr. Andy was hesitant to awaken Rachel for any reason, but this, he felt, couldn't wait. He carried the newspaper up to their bedroom. Alicia Buckler, a title examiner for the town of Nantucket, was reading the Globe while standing in line, waiting for a table at Black-Eyed Susan's along with the rest of the world. She turned to her wife, Janice, and pointed at the photo of Grace and Benton hanging from the tree branch.
"I think we've been working too hard," Alicia said. "We should take a vacation and goof off like these people."
Janice gasped.
"That's Grace Panchik," she said. "And Benton Coe."
Alicia thrust the paper at Janice in frustration.
She was sick and tired of the way Janice seemed to know everyone on the island just because she cleaned their teeth. And she was fed up with their Sunday routine of eating at Black-Eyed Susan's. Every week, an hour of their day was wasted by waiting in line.
Alicia pined for the olden days, when one could get breakfast at the Jared Coffin House. But if she brought this up, Janice would call her an old fuddy-duddy, and they would start to fight. Alicia was 8 months older than Janice, and she was sensitive about it.
"Enjoy your tofu benedict," Alicia said. "I'm going home."
But Janice didn't hear. She was too engrossed in the article. Glenn Daly rolled over and nearly crushed Barbie. They were lying in bed, drinking mimosas and reading the paper. Glenn had been with a lot of women. but never had he enjoyed creature comforts like good champagne and 500 thread-count sheets and fresh flowers by the bed the way he did with Barbie. And she smelled delicious, even when she first woke up. He didn't like to think that he was falling in love. His wife had ruined love for him forever, but he sure as hell didn't want to be doing anything else or be with anyone else on this Sunday morning.
"Look at this," Glenn said, showing Barbie the paper. "Your sister-in-law."
"Good God," Barbie said. Eddie. As the terrible old cliche goes, when it rains, it pours. On Friday afternoon, Eddie received not one, but two disturbing phone calls. One was from Madeline and Trevor's attorney, Leighton Gray, and one was from Philip Meyer at the bank. Leighton was calling about the investment of $50,000. His clients were very upset, Leighton said, and they wanted their money back. Eddie and Leighton had worked together on countless real estate deals. Eddie not only considered Leighton a good guy, he considered him a sort of friend. And so what bothered Eddie most about the message was Leighton's tone of voice. It was litigious and smoothly distant, with no hint that Leighton even knew Eddie, much less had thrown a few back with him at the bar at the Great Harbor Yacht Club. "Please call me to discuss," Leighton said, "before I have to take legal action."
Legal action?
Eddie didn't think there were grounds for legal action. It had been a good-faith investment. Madeline and Trevor had written a check, and Eddie had promised them double back, $100,000, once he sold the houses. He had made a photocopy of the check and written across the bottom of the page, "Llewellyn Investment in Eagle Wing Lane," and then the three of them had signed the paper, which Eddie again copied, giving the original to Madeline and Trevor and keeping the copy for himself. Nothing legal, nothing binding. A good-faith investment between friends. And yet the words, "good faith," gnawed at him. He couldn't default on this. He had to keep up his end of the bargain. And he certainly didn't want Leighton Gray to think that he, Eddie, had taken his friend's money and sunk it into a losing proposition. Leighton did 8 to 10 real estate closings a week. He dealt with every agency on Nantucket. If word about this got out... No, Eddie couldn't allow that to happen. He was livid that Madeline had called Leighton. Frankly, a part of him couldn't believe she'd actually done it. Lawyers cost money. If she had called, she was serious. He tried to calculate a way to get Madeline and Trevor at least a portion of their investment back. Once he closed the deal with Glenn Daly, even thinking the man's name gave Eddie heartburn, he might be able to put aside $10,000 for the Llewellyns. Maybe? Yes, he would do that. Then Philip Meyer had called and told Eddie that he was 90 days behind on the mortgage for his house.
"Wait a minute," Eddie said,